So welcome everyone tonight. we're entering the 10th picture of the Oxfording series. This one's entitled Entering the Marketplace, and I've subtitled it Integrity, Authenticity, and Ordinariness. And I'd just like to read what our placard says about the 10th picture, if I could. It says, barefooted and naked of breast, I mingle with the people of the world. My clothes are ragged and dust-laden, and I'm ever blissful. I have no magic to extend my life. Now, before me, the dead trees become alive. So I don't have too much commentary on that. Half naked and dusty. He enters the marketplace, and it reminds me of a story, I think it's a Zen story, of Manjushri, before he was an awakened man, was going up to seek solitude on top of a hillside, a mountaintop, and so he's journeying up the winding road of the mountaintop, just as this old man who's coming down, bald-headed, carrying his bundle on his shoulder, elderly, very rotund, is winding down the path. And as Manjushri is about to pass him, he thinks, well, maybe I'll ask this man about what enlightenment is. So he says to the man, sir, do you know anything about enlightenment? And the man drops his bundle. And it said in that moment, Manjushri awakened. And then Manjushri asked the man, he said, then now what? And the man picks up his bundle and heads back down to the city. Most of us are heading back into the city even before we drop the bundle. But that's okay. It works that way as well. In fact, the full embrace of our life is both the calling for our awakening and the proper orientation and integration of that awakening once it does happen. So we're sort of taking it on both. And I appreciate that in some ways because it makes the trip a little less convenient in the sense that we can't escape our everyday interactions to get somewhere in order to have a period of solitude and quiet. I mean, some of us can, but most of us are pretty much tied to our place here with responsibility, etc. And yet, if we carry the intention to awaken, nothing is lost. The problem is that intention slips, doesn't it? And so we keep meeting weekly or perhaps more frequently to gather the forces and energies together in order to recommit ourselves ongoingly, and that's what Sangha is, or one aspect of Sangha. It's also what your daily practice is. It's also what continual reminders that whatever difficulties we face, it's the mind's projection, the mind's reflection of what it holds and how it holds itself. So we're constantly looking, if we choose to see it this way, constantly staring at our own reflection, moment after moment, through most exchanges and interactions and difficulties throughout the day. But we lose reference to that. We think it's out there. We think it's somewhere else besides in ourselves that the trouble manifests. And so reminding us again and again about what I have called radical accountability is extremely important. And radical accountability, just to review for those of you who might not have heard that refrain, is that we don't, regardless of what's occurring within us, we don't frame it so that something's doing it to us. We hold the thoughts, we hold the emotions, the moods, the attitudes, the disposition of whatever it is that's going on, without slippage, without letting that become someone else's problem that we're blaming it on, or some other situation that we're constantly excusing our own behavior for to point and blame life. So radical accountability is an absolute refusal to allow ourselves not to be responsible, or absolute certainty that we are responsible for our own inward life. And that, if you look, it's all inward life, so that pretty much takes care of everything. Thoughts, emotions, moods, dispositions, attitudes, everything. It's all coming from us. To hold that allows us to actually be an orientation in a proper way to awakening. Because if there is slippage, if there is blame, and we're not responsible for it, then we are essentially saying that life is doing it to us. Life is doing it to us. And we can take a very pitied attitude to that, a victim attitude. But in fact, it's not doing it to us. The truth is that we're doing it to ourselves by how it is that we hold or what it is that we're saying about life in that moment. I think Shanti Davis said very nicely, he says, we are not here to change the world is here to change us. And in an orientation, in alignment with that, is what I call radical accountability. Now, instead of making this too esoteric and talking about what that old man must have been seeing and philosophizing about his inward life, I would much rather make this pragmatic and look at upon this as a journey consisting of three qualities: the quality of integrity, of authenticity, integrity, and ordinariness. And it doesn't mean, what it does is it allows us some way to orient and posture ourselves to the circumstances of life and to our life in general, that even though it may not be as yet that we have awakened, at least when we're in the right orientation through these words to life, we allow awakening to happen to us. It's the best environment, the optimum environment, to allow awakening to happen. If we are being inauthentic and partial and superficial, it doesn't allow that possibility in. So it sort of cleans the room, sweeps it out, and opens the window so that the breeze can come in, if the breeze so happens to blow. And so I'd like to go and just talk about three qualities, if I could, tonight. And if you would just think and reflect upon your life in relationship to these three qualities, I think it could be very helpful. Because culturally, they're not encouraged. These qualities are not encouraged culturally. And in fact, not much of Dharma is. So we just have to, we have to have some self-reliance here. We can't expect culture in general to lead us in a proper orientation to waking up. In fact, the deeper the sleep, the better the culture likes us. When you understand that, you don't rely on it. You don't get angry at it. You just don't rely on it. And that throws much more of an emphasis on the community we do have together, because you see that other communities that aren't focused in this direction can really lead us astray. So let's look at these, if we could. And the first one I'd like to take tonight is authenticity, authentic. It's a word that many, many people resonate deeply with, being authentic, especially in a culture that seems anything but authentic, doesn't it? And yet, there are three provisions that I would like to bring into what authenticity means. I'd just like to throw these statements out and then say a little bit about them, because they really hold the essence of what it means to be genuine. And the first of those is to know what we are. And that has many, many different levels of orientation. But at the heart of it, the depth of it, the where these ox-herding pictures are taking us, is that most of us do not know where what we are. Or what. Let me just stay with the what we are. Some of us are confused about who we are, which is a whole different psychological question, but what we are really gets to the point. Now, how can we be authentic if we don't know what we are? What are we being authentic to? You see? So to understand the depth of Dharma is to allow, and could somebody get the, to allow a proper orientation to the genuine truth of who we are, and then we can then relax within that orientation, because once we are properly, once ourselves is properly understood, it's not, we don't then have to go on to a into a long journey of being authentic. Authenticity is simply abiding within what we are, what we are. And that is most of Dharma practice, is to understand that fact. What are we? What is this thing? To invite the question that stirs some, perhaps some anxiety about where the question could go. But then if we have an authentic heart, it's not going to release that question merely because we get a little disturbed by asking it. It's going to pursue it beyond some of the levels of anxiety we may hold it, and begin to move us more and more deeply into a proper orientation of life, in essence, to abiding within that question. What are we? What is this? Who are we? Now, I mean, we start this questioning, and I'm not going to be spending a lot of time on this, so some of you can relax a little. But even to know who we are, to see where we give ourselves away in life, to see how we compromise ourselves psychologically, is a first start. How we look into somebody's eyes, we determine what they want from us, and then we change ourselves in accordance with what we have thought that they want, what they want from us, their need for us to be a certain way. And if we don't have a ground under us, if we don't know who we are, we're going to constantly give ourselves away. Or perhaps we've been incited by our parents or by those close to us to have a certain disposition, even though we don't feel like that is an authentic disposition. We still have been encouraged for such a long period of time to have that disposition that we can't shake it. When I was young, my mother would bring me down to introduce me to her friends. And, she kind of programmed me to say, you know, how are you, and shake hands and do this whole thing. And it was so cute, right? It was a little kid doing this kind of obedient thing. And I remember I was like performing. And she would call me down to meet all of her friends, and I would just keep performing, shaking hands and doing this, and then I would hear their rancor when I got left. Oh, wasn't he cute? Yes, he was, you know, wasn't that sweet? Come down and do it again. You know, it's like. And I felt this burden of being this proper kid. And I didn't really appreciate it. It didn't allow me, manners, I'm not saying to be, not to have proper manners with my elders, but it just kept me in a kind of contained way that I felt violated in some way. And to this day, when somebody sticks out their hand, that image comes back. So it can stay with us for a long period of time, this kind of inauthenticity in us. Where we're held to a certain disposition to be liked, to be kind, to be loving, to be something, and feel very contained by the pressures that we feel, that we hold on ourselves, not the culture is doing it to us. Remember, it's all us that we inflict upon ourselves to maintain that disposition. And so authenticity, even at that level, to know who we are even at that level of personality, doesn't mean that we, that some people think authenticity is just saying whatever you want to anybody, being as rude as you'd like just because you have a disposition towards that end. It's not that at all. Rudeness isn't authentic. But being caught into a cultural enclave, a kind of corridor of disposition isn't authentic either. So we have to find a way through this and to see if there is pain that is driving whatever disposition we might be in. If we're afraid, if we hold ourselves constantly to being nice, what is it that's driving that niceness? What is it that's back there that I'm afraid of people seeing if I'm not nice? And can I be authentic with myself and look at it? That's the question we're asking. Not for people to see my unkind side necessarily, but for me to be aware of it. For me to see what's driving that. And so that's an important question of authenticity. The second one is to know where we are. If we don't know what we are or where we are, we're really lost on the seas here. Know where we are. And we think, well, of course I know where we are. But do we? I mean, today I was folding clothes and my mind was shifting to the Dharma talk. And so I was folding clothes kind of rote, you know. And I thought, wait a minute. What am I talking? What am I going to talk about tonight if I'm not doing it? If I'm not actually showing up, embodying my presence? What is this about? Showing up, embodying ourselves, knowing our orientation, knowing where we are on the earth, instead of this infested busyness that we all have, or that many of us have, that keep us sort of two dominoes down the line, and we're thinking about where we should be as we're doing something entirely different. Or thinking about where we are going, why we're two steps behind. And is that authentic? You see, that question resonates so deeply that you immediately know it's not. It's here, it's now, or it's never. It's here and now, or it's never. And lo and behold, when I do start showing up, I also begin to see many of the ways that I have been authentic in myself for not showing up. What I've done to myself to keep myself stressfully involved in leaning into the future so that I won't show up to the whoever it is that I think I am here. It's very convenient to say I don't know who I am when I don't show up for who I am. When we show up for who we are, we see who we are, and we realize why we never wanted to show up, because there's a lot of inauthenticity here that we have to really look through and perceive. And it's very humbling, and it's continually humbling to me. It's one of the most amazing facts in practice. No matter how long you've been practiced, you'll be humbled by yourself and all of our inauthentic ways. And the third question is not to give ourselves away. And now, what I mean by that is once we know where we are and who we are, not to give ourselves away from those coordinates. And we can do that in a myriad of ways that I've already spoken about, but more importantly, when we're willing to hold the moment as our abiding presence, then that is a statement. When we want something or fear something, we are giving part of ourselves away. When we are here, being present with ourselves, there's nothing that is out of alignment. Everything is perfectly appropriate. And then we start wanting or fearing something from our location, from something, not something that's present that we don't want to be here, or something that's not present that we do. And suddenly we're lost. We've given ourselves away. We're no longer in this moment. We're no longer in our embodied posture. We no longer know who we are. We're the person who wants or fears. And we have sort of become vague to ourselves as we start pursuing objects or fearing objects and all of that. So the questions that I would like for us to ask are those questions of orientation for authenticity. What is this? Where are we? And am I giving myself away within this reality? And those are, if we want coordinates to find the word authenticity, those do a very exacting job. They show us exactly on the map where authenticity is. So we see our work cut out for us. We see what needs to be done. We see why it is that we have such an ambiguous relationship with life in general, with ourselves, with everything, and certainly with the word authenticity, because we haven't lined ourselves up, perhaps, to those basic questions and statements that allow us to gain some footage and know ourselves well enough so that we can then pronounce our life, address our life from that place, from this place in time. And again, that's where radical accountability comes in, because that will throw you off quicker than anything. The projections of what you think other people are thinking about you, you'll lose your own coordinates very quickly, and suddenly you'll try to compensate for what you think they're thinking about you as if you knew, instead of knowing that those thoughts are coming from me and they don't need correction, they just need to be seen. In fact, awareness has the ability to hold the authentic. Not my moods, not my thoughts. If I'm governed by my moods and thoughts, I'm going to be just like a cork on the ocean. But the awareness of those things begins to establish the reference that they can give me, the reflection back that I can see that they're coming from me, and also ground me in the here and now, the authentic moment of time. We think our way out of authenticity. If we were quiet and still with ourselves, we would be authentic. We think ourselves out of authenticity. Our suppositions of life, what we suppose and project upon life, those all become the blurring image that we have of life. Now, I mean, basic to all of this, of course, is the fact that authentically, we are not what we pretend to be. And I don't just mean being nice when you don't feel that way. I mean being a person, an individual, an entity, a separate self, an individuated me. That's a supposition, that's an idea. And that idea has to be seen through, or we are constantly going to be vague in our authenticity. Because if we invest in something that isn't true, how can that be authentic? And so seeing through that vagueness in an exact way is very important, essential really, for an authentic life. And this constant need that we have, that shows our inauthenticity really, this need to check, you know, the commentator. See, once the images come in and we think that the images are coming from the outside, then we have to comment and judge and censor those images to keep ourselves at bay from overextending where we don't think it's appropriate, and we have to comment on everything we see and experience that we think is coming from the outside. And so all that weighing in and pondering and judging, all of that is the inauthentic voice. Inauthentic voice. That need to step back out of the moment where to try to save our life, to try to save our individuated life, to try to protect ourselves, to try to keep us out of harm's way or to gain what we want. That stepping back and reflective sense of myself upon life is inauthentic in and of itself. And this then says, well, why is that inauthentic? Well, let's move into the word integrity, which is the second word I'd like to talk about this evening. Because seeing what's all inauthentic is not enough. Seeing what's inauthentic and then allowing what's authentic to arise by no longer infusing or investing in what's inauthentic. Integrity is the willingness to integrate in body, speech, and mind in an authentic way. That's what integrity means. It comes from the word integer, which is a whole number. It's the state of being unimpaired, an unobstructed truth. Now, let me bring in meditation, which I like to do on these talks, to show you how meditation is an attempt towards integrity, towards an unimpaired wholeness. When we sit down, if we are establishing our attention on the breath, that's fine, but then at some point, we just want to release the need to have to observe anything in particular. And this allows the whole of life to be observed. The room floods with awareness, and everything within awareness can be seen. And that sense of being is sort of cave-like in our noticing of breath, rising, falling, or in and out, or whatever, then begins to be almost an open field of observation of things just coming and going as they will. This is an unimpaired vision of life. It's unimpaired in the sense that everything is just coming and going in a choiceless, aware way. I'm not selecting anything out. I'm not leaning into one thing as being desired over and above something else. I'm not infusing or investing in any experience as being better than another experience. I'm simply allowing the whole array of experiences to show themselves just as they do. Thoughts, emotions, sounds, sights, all of them, just coming and going. And we can see then that meditation from this definition, is a holistic approach to ourselves, because even the sense of ourselves is part of what we're observing. We have an emotion that's being felt or seen. We have an idea or thought, and that's also moving through this vast space. Now, some of you haven't been able to come to that sense of stillness yet in the meditation. It will come. If you keep practicing, it will come. And when you get that, when you first have it, it sort of might feel like it's hard to establish. And in the beginning, it may feel as if it's hard to establish that kind. But there's an immediate sense of integration, of things coming and going on their own, not through my force of will, not through my tension, not through my worry, that everything is light, much lighter than we had supposed it to be, and much less self-influenced. We begin to get a sense then that completion does not have to be under my control, that in fact it can be just the opposite. That maybe it's how I'm acknowledging this moment rather than what's in this moment that makes it complete or incomplete. Maybe if I'm unaware of a particular desire or fear I have in me and play the moment through that perception, then I will have a sense of this moment being incomplete. Because I will look upon whatever this moment is and has from that sense of neediness, never seeing it, that it's an experience too. But if I'm quiet enough so that I can see this sense of incompleteness as another experience within the moment, then what's wrong with the moment, even if it contains incompleteness? One, I'm looking through the incompleteness for my determinants of how to get out of it. The other, I'm looking at incompleteness as a part of the whole totality of this moment. And those are two very different ways to perceive reality. Very different. One is an integer, a whole number. Because we realize from our radical accountability that even the sense of incompleteness is another internal experience that I'm applying towards what I perceive as external life. The other is just an experience of not pleasant. Feeling incomplete isn't pleasant. But it isn't inviting a response that would make this moment a bridge towards a future completion. What we begin to see from that perspective is that the whole is more than the sum of its parts. That sense of integration of the moment is more than just the experiences that are contained in the moment. That there is something else that comes out, that arises from that sense of integrated moment in time. And that's presence, that's awareness. It rises up from that. So it's not like I'm hearing, listening, smelling, tasting, hearing thoughts, feeling this, that, and that somehow all of those things come in kind of rapid succession is the moment. No, something else comes in and fills the moment. And when those aren't invested in, it all becomes very quiet. And that sense of presence, we immediately realize, is the integer, the oneness, the whole number of us. So now we have not only the disposition of totality, but we also begin to see what is authentic within the moment is not all of my labor and leaning and maneuvering and posturing within that moment, but just the sense of awareness that fills the vastness of this moment. And where is the me in there? I'm not even needed. It's all happening. It's not dependent upon any aspect of me for its occurrence. In fact, in the knowing of that uncertainty is the realization of our own emptiness. In this sense, then, that something is missing or there's not enough or that this shouldn't be happening cues us immediately, this should not be happening, towards a spiritual deficit. Something, and we get it because it's a cry of pain. This should not be happening is a cry of pain. What shouldn't be happening? What shouldn't be happening? A lot of things I don't like happening. I can certainly take that road. But what shouldn't be happening? See, we so easily play God, don't we? This should not be happening. But it is happening. So the argument's over. Now, one thing I'd just like to say as an aside, that we use forms in our life to remind us to be responsible. And meditation is one of those forms that we use to remind us that we are accountable to ourselves and that we don't let slippage occur where we start blaming others for our moods. You make me happy, you make me angry, and all that. Now, so meditation, when we practice it, and I hope all of you are doing it daily or maybe twice a day, so that it carries over. You get a sense of the drift of meditation as it carries beyond the sitting, so that we don't come back in with the same sense of myself and others during meditation. We let this sense of integrated oneness carry itself forth a little bit after the meditation. And so the meditation is kind of a practice for how to hold the world all the time. And very quickly I have found that it slips. That gets obscured very quickly if we let that pass too many days. I'll meditate in action. Do you? It's fine, but do you? Do you? The other forms that are very helpful, and just knowing when we have split away from the integer of life, precepts. When we violate precepts, we are fracturing life towards our advantage. That's not an integrated response. That's not an authentic response. So these things are not calls for self-beratement, but they show us where we have slipped in our view and disposition towards what we know fundamentally to be true. Sangha is another one that's very helpful in reinforcing that sense of interconnectedness. So to use these different forms to help us remind ourselves that we are accountable, that we are responsible. We lie, we don't blame the lie on the situation that unfolded. Okay, we did that. Now what is it that happened there? What was I trying to protect? What was I trying to defend that led to that lie? So let me just be honest with that. So everywhere we're honest, we begin to move towards an authentic integration. Dishonesty immediately breaks us off from that, and we got it. We get cued into an honest relationship with things. It's a necessity, absolute necessity. Now, we come to the third word, which is ordinary. And that usually brings people a little bit of their feathers get ruffled in that word, because ordinary is not a word that any of us particularly like. We want to be extraordinary. We want to rise above the median. We want ourselves to be known. We want us to be acclaimed, noticed. And yet, this old man with his bundle on his back walking down the hillside, laughing and joking, it would be hard for people to even recognize that there is anything extraordinary about him or her in their full awakening, except that they were authentic and somehow integrated and grounded in themselves, and extraordinarily simple and ordinary. Not simple-minded, but simple of being. Not dependent upon hyperbole, exaggeration, not dependent upon intensity or entertainment or something that their life or their sense of aliveness was connected to at all. In fact, it wasn't connected to anything. They were alive for its own sake, for its own sake. And ordinariness has that feeling of complete, it's without, there's nothing reverent within it, and yet there is something sacred within it. Have you ever felt that with someone? That you can't pick out exactly what it is that brings your heart out, but that there's something, and sometimes if you just look over your life, you quite likely have met awakened people, but you didn't know it. But there is this sense, whoa, that was an amazing encounter I just had. I had one on a bus one time, and the person didn't do anything at all except answer my question. And years later, I now recognize that as a very awake man. But there have been teachers, and there's no light shining on them. There's nothing acclaiming about him or her. And perhaps it's nothing but an extraordinary authenticity and simplicity of spirit that arouses our heart to meet theirs. But much of our life, especially in this culture, is a flight from the ordinary. We do not like the ordinary. In fact, we equate the ordinary with the mundane, with the boring, and we try to do anything else. I mean, I've seen high schoolers, been a high school student myself, and those years, those terribly difficult, painful years in which someone called them the looking class self years. And you can feel in that high school mentality, which many of us were molded by, many of us were formed through those years, and still carry the disposition of how we were held in high school. And that those terribly troubling times when the worst thing you could possibly be was ordinary. Because if you didn't have good looks, or you weren't intelligent, or you didn't have this sports stuff and that, then you were thrown into this holding space of just ordinary. Terribly confusing. And to this day, many of us still bristle with being ordinary or being thought of in that way. And so we try to just something, some way to just establish some uniqueness, some form of authenticity that we think is authentic, usually through appearance, but it may not be. It could be through disposition. Being weird, one thing is to be weird and not know you're weird, the other is to be weird and try to be weird, right? So as a role, terribly confusing. Because what we're really saying is, am I worth your attention? Because I'm not worth my own. Would you please pay attention to me? But don't pay too close attention to me, or you'll see what I don't want you to see about myself. So what I'll do is I'll rest your observation on my appearance, because if I can keep you skin deep, then I don't have to show you the metal that I'm so afraid of inside. The pain of that. The pain of that. We think that demons lurk in there, as we walk around feeling like a mistake. So this is what we're up against. We're up against a society that says if you're average, I mean, everybody's average. I mean, it's got to be that way, you know, the bell curve and all that. How many people are out there on the fringes of that? That's most of us are right there in the middle of that bell curve. And to be able to settle with that authentically, and okay, so, you know, believe me, when I'm up here speaking, I know I'm not the most intelligent person because the words don't come even that I used to be because they don't come like they used to come. Okay, so that's it. There's not a thing I can do except begrudge it. Well, I'd rather not that. So that's it. This is called aging. And suddenly this inward rhythm, this inward harmony starts to become so compelling. It's like being in the forests. Even amongst people. That the rhythm and harmony is the sacred. And everything that calls us away from that is to be released. And that becomes a spiritual, that becomes the way we handle our spiritual. Because we feel the resonance of what it means to be authentic, to be integrated and to be ordinary. And anything that seems to call us away from that, any intonation in oneself, neediness or any of that, immediately becomes the cue for us to turn and look. See, what's going on here? Why would I want to do that? It's become so obvious that that's the course of insanity. And so we just stop giving ourselves away and we're willing to face, well, did you do that? Yes, I did it. You did? Yes, I did. I said that. I apologize or whatever we have to say, but yeah, that's it. I did it. And it's ended. How much? And everybody usually knows when you're not being truthful anyway. I mean, it's not as if people feel the incongruence of the energy. If you're really perceptive, you can pick it up almost immediately. We don't get away with it. Not for very long anyway. So it's just easier just to admit it, just to be congruent. Okay, got it. This is it. Yeah, I did it. Well, you'll go to jail. Well, I'll go to jail. Just that. And we live with that. We integrate, authentically integrate ourselves into actions of body, speech, and mind. Knowing ourselves, knowing what this is, and not being fooled by it any longer. Just the ordinary, just the simple, just the sacred. Thank you all. Can we sit for a minute or two? So sitting as you sit, as we sit right now, just sitting. Just to let everything in your mind be. In your body. Don't invest in any experience as being significant. And perhaps we can get a sense of a space unfolding. Something that rises up. Something quiet and full and authentic and integrated. And although sacred, extraordinarily ordinary. Any questions at all? Yes. Yes, yes, yes.
Be with it. And then you said something that, after all, it's only a reflection of our own. It itself is also not even.
Right, yes. I can't, if I'm getting you right, though the question is about, I think what you're saying is about the feeling discontented and. So when we're feeling discontented, the whole world is discontented because we're looking through discontentedness, and the whole world feels insufficient. I feel insufficient within the world. The world doesn't feel insufficient. I feel insufficient within the world, and my job is to balance that insufficiency. So whatever it is that I'm feeling, I'm taking to be real, and I'm now acting upon that internalized truth, and I'm playing out whatever pattern that truth has taken. It may mean that I have to, you know, get some particular, pursue some desire, or avoid something, or nourish myself somehow, or entertain myself somehow. But that insufficiency, that background white noise that many of us have that just continuously carries the note of insufficiency, that if we ever stop long enough, we feel insufficient, which keeps us going again, acts as a stimulation or as a cattle prod for us to do the next thing so that we can stay one step ahead of that insufficiency. Suddenly I'm seeing myself driven by it. All along I've taken that to be the state of affairs, just who I am, right? I'm insufficient. My assumptions are built around that, my moods, my attitudes, my disposition, all around the truth of the mood that's now arising. And so naturally, when I've had a life and lived a life in which I feel like a mistake, when I feel insufficient, I don't want anyone to see the mistake I'm feeling that I am, so I then go out and act out in a way that would counterbalance that by being arrogant or something, right? So it can be whole styles and approach to life that can come from a particular root issue that I've assumed to be true in myself. All right, so in meditation, and I hope all of us are coming to the point where we're questioning that. Because when we look at the mind, we don't see something there that has history and that has truth in the history and that has a disposition from the history and therefore forced to act out the history. That's where we're coming from. That's not the spiritual. The spiritual is to take this thing apart, to hold the emotion, to feel the impulse, to look at the assumptions of inadequacy, to take this thing apart, to look it in the eye with awareness and to be able to see that these things were an aggregated way of holding myself to get through whatever childhood experiences I had to get through to survive. And this is the damage of that survival, my mind. And so I look at my mind, isn't it? So I look at my mind with a new sense of sincerity. Okay, let me look. And I feel the mood. I feel insufficient. But I say, okay, let me just, what if I looked at the insufficiency rather than through the insufficiency? Through the insufficiency ties me to the whole pattern and story of the insufficiency. Looking at the insufficiency, I'm out of it. And yes, it's felt, but it's felt as a feeling rather than as an abiding truth. Now, I don't have to, okay, so now insufficiency, now I've got it. So now it's okay. This is a feeling. First of all, what feeling can't we feel? Well, usually the feelings we can't feel are the ones that we believe to be true about us that really nail us. So, as I've said many times, I'm not going to go into right now, but you can. You have to look at the assumptions behind the feelings to uproot that sense of the neediness to get out of myself, which is the reason we take it and say, enough of this, I'm out of here. Thank you, one class and I'm out. Okay. But now, okay, so let me feel insufficient. As soon as we're willing to stand our ground and be authentic to insufficiency, to be authentic, it integrates, insufficiency integrates into all things and gets quiet because it can't withstand our lack of fear. Our fear was the investing, what gave it energy and pronouncement and distinction was our fear. Once we have divested our fear by just observing it, feeling it, it has no other thing. It just, that can't do it. Other things will come up, but not that one. We're on to it. And so we start melding ourselves away, or whittling ourselves away, whatever metaphor you like. And so what is it that drives you when everything else has been dissolved? When you're not driven by your insufficiency, your inadequacy, your lack of the dot, 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 what is it that drives us? Don't you want to find that out? What if you didn't move from your old conditioning? What would move it? Would you just die? That's not what the old man did when he picked up the bundle and headed back down the... He didn't say, well, now what? He didn't lay on the road and go, maggots. No. He picked his bundle back up. What moved him? What moved him? You see? It's a different organ. And I'll point there, but whatever you think I'm pointing to is not what I'm pointing to. I'll point to the heart. I'll point to the heart. So it becomes very interesting. All it does is take a, just, I see it. Once we see it, we're authentically present with something. We can't be inauthentic to it anymore. And every one of our practices, this is, if you're practicing in a wise direction, goes through this inevitability. But you have to be doing it. You have to infuse it with intention. You have to, you know, you can't, it can't be just a byproduct of everything else you do during the day. This has to be the most important thing. And everything else comes through that. Because if other things are more important, then you're going to be driven by what's more important, which means you're looking through your need to be important and be driven by that. So this has to be most important because when you have made that, then you can see everything, all other aspects of importance, you can see importance. And you won't be looking through importance. You understand what I'm saying? Yeah, good. So this has to be, you see, it has to be. I mean, it's not like, you know, I want a bunch of really good students, so, you know, no. I don't, you know, that's not the motivation. The motivation is that if you want to be free, this is what you have to do. But the problem is that the reason that we falter, and I mean, most of us in the room don't want to do that. So does it mean that we're all, you know, destined for? No. Just watch what your life is doing to you through looking through it. Watch the bruises on your head. Feel the bumps. You won't hold yourself accountable unless you hold yourself accountable. Hold yourself accountable to the bruises you have. You're doing it to yourself by looking through life in that manner. Is life paying off for you or not doing that? And soon your heart will turn itself around. But if you try to pretend that it's just because of circumstances or a bad partner or a bad job or a bad boss or a bad neighbor or, you know, or bad mind. If I had a better mind, this is all. You see, that's not being accountable. This whole thing has to, okay, got it, it's all me. So you look at the bruises as being self-inflicted. That's a very different way of looking at bruises than you did, why did you bruise me? And then you go, wow, God, life is just living through the mind. Life lived through the mind is a horror show. Life living, seeing the mind is quite amazing, really. Other questions? Yes. Yes.
And when you're not grounded, you might gravitate towards, you know, the arrogance, like you were talking about, or
yes.
Self-standards,
yes.
More than being really in your...
Yes, that's right. So her statement really wasn't a question, was that this sense of holding oneself requires accountability. Because you can't hold yourself if you're excusing why you are the way you are. Most of us meet our limitations with excuses, don't we? So, if we do that, then we can't. There's nothing to hold. It's all loose. It's leakage. To hold ourselves, we say we have to be radically honest. Say, okay, yeah, this is me. I did it, or whatever. Then you have something to hold. You don't have something to hold when you're trying to get out of your skin, or we don't know where we are on the earth. When we're so busy that where we are is secondary to where we want to go, what kind of a life is that? How can you hold a life that that we don't even reside in? I mean, some of it's so obvious, isn't it? But now you've got to do it. You can't just know it. You see, I'm now beyond the willingness to let people just, yes, nod their head and then go off and... No, that's nothing more than coming and listening to a Sunday sermon. What are you going to do to turn this thing around? How are you going to integrate? How are we, all of us, going to integrate, integer, integrity? How are we going to move this thing into body, speech, and mind? Because if we don't, nothing changes. And it will really be no more than a Sunday afternoon in church.
Or equate to the first provision, because sometimes
No, okay, so the question is, your question is kind of broad, so I'm going to try to, okay? But if I don't answer it, you can ask it again, okay? So, knowing what you are and knowing, the difference between knowing what you are and knowing who you are. It's interesting, isn't it? What do you call who or what? What are those things? What are, in grammar, what are those things?
Pronouns.
It's the difference is in the pronoun. Who is a person? Me, right? Who am I? And when you ask yourself from a pronoun point of view, you come up with traits, characters, qualities, personalities, that sort of thing. So you can tell me, you can give me the logistics of where you're from, you know, what you've done, and your personality and qualities. And that's the who of you. Now, the what of you is something very different. When you don't look at yourself as an entity of something established with that degree of certainty that who, the pronoun who, establishes, when you ask what am I, the question opens this whole thing up beyond a pronounced individuated me. What is this thing? How does it work? What's the mechanism? How does this thing feel so certain that I am here and everything is out there? Is that the truth? And at this point, let us say I don't know. Is that the truth or is that an assumption? And if it's an assumption, what's the assumption based on? How did I get to this derivation of perception where it looks as if everything is outside of me? So now I'm saying I don't know whether everything's outside of me. It looks as if, but I've heard the mystics' perennial philosophies say that that's not so. So let me look and see. So now instead of asking my questions from the assertion of the assumption and the truth of the assumption of who, I'm looking at the very questioner who's asking the questions. Who is asking or what is asking the question? That's an inward awareness. That's not an intellectual philosophy. What is this thing? So I have dealt with that in other classes and I'll deal with it in future classes, but I didn't want to get too bogged down in that technicality at the moment. But to know who we are will take us to an authentic to authenticity, because then we'll know what we're not and we'll give up the inauthenticity. When you know what you're not going to operate from and act from that ignorance. But until you see it as ignorance, you're going to operate it as if it were true. So when you see what you're not, a lot of behaviors fall away. A lot of behaviors fall away, as they should, right? Okay, all. Thank you very much for this evening. Now, next week, we will be moving on to a different series. The end of the ox herding pictures is tonight. We leave the ox, the pastor, and the herder aside, but carry them with you. This is spirited. Some of you liked them, some of you didn't. But it was a spirited way to look and investigate at the journey of where we are. And remembering that the path was circular, it wasn't about a progression. It was like a circular spiral staircase. All of us go through each one of these in the course, perhaps, of a single day. And to be able to realize what it is, the value and the limitations of each perspective can be very helpful. So I hope the series was useful to you.